Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Brian Lynn, Faith Lapidus, Bob Doty, and Shirley Griffith. But first, this report. Completing a degree program at a college or university can be one of the best things you do to improve your chances of success in life. Higher education is a necessity for many of the best-paying jobs in the United States and other countries. But earning a degree can also be one of the most difficult things you will ever attempt. In 2019, a nonprofit group noted that 36 million Americans had started on a path towards a degree, but stopped before completing their studies. That number came from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. In 2016, the European Union found that 3 million young people throughout its member nations had suspended their university education. In 2017, the World Bank reported that across South America, nearly half of all 25 to 29-year-olds had stopped attending higher education without earning a degree. And South African officials have reported similar levels in their country. Nicole Torpisebo says there are many reasons why people leave U.S. higher education without earning a degree. And the difficulty of college degree programs is not the top reason people give for leaving, she adds.
Torpisebo is director of research for the Strata Education Network. In December, her group, working with the research company Gallup, released a report on why over 42,000 Americans left school without a degree. Researchers found the most common reason people gave for leaving was the difficulty of balancing work with their college or university studies. Other reasons were the high cost of higher education and the fact that many students failed to see how their studies related to a career, Torpisebo says. As for why so few consider returning to complete their education, she told VOA, many Americans feel there is little chance of them succeeding if they do. They are afraid that they've been away from the classroom too long, or they're just worried that the same situations that caused them to drop out before might still be there and make it difficult to be successful if they try again, she said. Torpisebo suggests the problem in the United States is not just that these individuals have less of a chance of finding good-paying jobs. These men and women still have to repay loans they took out to pay for their education. And since they will likely have less access to better positions, they will struggle to repay that debt.
This makes an already difficult situation for people who are poor or come from an underrepresented group in higher education that much harder, notes Justin Ortegas. Ortegas is an assistant professor of higher education policy at the University of Florida in Gainesville. He believes that students like these are often the most likely to drop out. If you're a low-income, first-generation student, you don't necessarily have a parent to say, this is what you need to do to enroll, or these are the types of courses you need to take to ensure you're up to date in your individual major. You kind of have to learn on the fly and really rely on under-resourced institutions to provide the support and services that you need, he said. Yet Ortegas thinks there is hope. Last month, he and two other University of Florida researchers released a study on efforts to readmit students at two-year community colleges across the state. Community colleges largely serve poor and minority students, many who are working in full-time positions and supporting families. Federal studies show that only about 30% of individuals who start their education at such schools earn a degree.
However, the study showed that community colleges were able to help students return in two ways. First, the schools started sending text messages to over 27,000 former students on their mobile phones. The messages provided links so they could immediately enroll in classes or get advice about the next best steps in their education. The community colleges also offered to pay students for their first class once they decided to return to school. The text messages alone had little effect. But the two efforts together made the individuals in the study 21% more likely to re-enroll. Ortegas argues that this demonstrates how a little financial aid, in this case about $300, can do a lot for those in need. And eventually, the cost to the school is covered when the students are in a better position to pay for the rest of their education. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories, our weekly program about common, everyday expressions in American English. Today, we are talking about this somewhat unusual day of February 29th. It comes up on the calendar only every 4 years. A year with a February 29th might be good news if you are paid by the day or the week. But it might be bad news if you were born on a February 29th. You have to wait 3 years in between birthdays. In any case, American English has a term for the unusual situation. February 29th is called a leap day, and the entire 12-month period with a February 29th in it is called a leap year. This year, 2020, is such a year. As a verb, the word leap means to jump or to move quickly. Leap can also be a noun, meaning a jump or a sudden move. In a leap year, the dates jump over one day of the week. Let me explain. In 2017, the last day of the year, December 31st, fell on a Sunday. In 2018, it fell on a Monday. In 2019, it fell on a Tuesday. But in 2020, December 31st will fall on a Thursday. It just leaped right over Wednesday. The reason for a leap day or a leap year is because our calendar does not follow the Earth's orbit around the sun exactly. Each year, we have a little time left over. So, every 4 years, we put all that time together into an extra day, or what is officially called an intercalary day. But I have never, ever heard an English speaker use that term. Leap day is fine. Leap is also an important word for two other common, but opposing, American expressions. One is a kind of warning. If you want someone to investigate a situation completely before taking action, you might say, look before you leap. The other expression is a phrase of hope. Urging someone to take a leap of faith invites the person to take action, even if not everything about a situation is known. Interestingly, both phrases are completely reasonable to say to someone who is about to get married. On that note, some people choose to marry on February 29th because it is an unusual date. One wedding chapel in the U.S. city of Las Vegas is even offering a free ceremony for those who decide to take the leap into marriage on the last day of this month. The ceremony is followed by a chance to skydive together, that is, jump out of an airplane with a parachute. But some ancient peoples would likely tell couples not to do it. Leap years were believed to be difficult, and leap days unlucky, at a bad time to begin anything new. Whatever you think about them, the change in the calendar will be gone soon enough. Then we can return to normal and leap over February 29th as usual. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
American technology company SpaceX says it plans to launch as many as 4 private citizens into a higher orbit than ever before. SpaceX is working with U.S.-based Space Adventures, Inc. to offer the space flights, the two companies recently announced. No dates or costs for the flights were announced. Space Adventures has already helped send 7 space tourists to the International Space Station, or ISS, aboard Russian Soyuz rockets. The SpaceX trips will not send the space tourists to the ISS. Instead, the tourists will be launched to an orbit 2 to 3 times higher, about 800 to 1,200 kilometers above Earth. The citizens will be carried by SpaceX's Crew Dragon spacecraft, which was developed to transport NASA astronauts. SpaceX is planning to use the Crew Dragon to launch its first NASA crewed flight later this year. The spacecraft has only flown in space once so far, completing a successful test flight last year with no crew. A spokeswoman for Space Adventures, Stacy Tierna, told the Associated Press that the tourist flights could take place by the end of next year. She said the company was already in talks with several possible customers. Tierna noted that no professional pilot or astronaut would be required on the tourist flights, because the Dragon operates fully autonomously. Passengers will, however, be able to control the spacecraft if required, she added. The cost will be similar to earlier tourist flights, Tierna said. Canadian billionaire Guy Laliberté, founder of Cirque du Soleil, paid $35 million for a 10-day space station flight in 2009. He said from orbit that the flight was worth every penny and more. The first private citizen to fly in space was Dennis Tito, a California businessman.
He paid $20 million for an 8-hour stay on the ISS in 2001. This historic mission will forge a path to making spaceflight possible for all people who dream of it, said Gwen Shotwell, President and Chief Operating Officer of SpaceX. The President of Space Adventures, Eric Anderson, said the tourist flights would be able to reach at least twice the orbit of any past citizen astronaut mission or space station visitor. That orbit would also place the tourist flights well beyond the levels of other companies that currently offer space tourism flights. Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic and Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin are both developing spacecraft to send private citizens to just beyond the border of space, about 80 kilometers above Earth. The price for Virgin Galactic flights started at $250,000 when they first went on sale in 2004. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1920s are remembered as a quiet period in American foreign policy. The nation was at peace. Americans elected three Republican presidents in a row: Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. These conservatives in the White House were generally more interested in economic growth at home than in relations with other countries. But the United States had become a world power. It was tied to other countries by trade, politics, and shared interests. And America had gained new economic strength. Bob Doty and Shirley Griffith discuss American foreign policy during the 1920s.
Before World War I, foreigners invested more money in the United States than Americans invested in other countries, about $3 billion more. The war changed this. By 1919, Americans had almost $3 billion more invested in other countries than foreign citizens had invested in the United States. American foreign investments continued to increase greatly during the 1920s. Increased foreign investment was not the only sign of growing American economic power. By the end of World War I, the United States produced more goods and services than any other nation, both in total and per person. Americans had more steel, food, cloth, and coal than even the richest foreign nations. By 1920, the United States' national income was greater than the combined incomes of Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, and 17 smaller countries. Quite simply, the United States had become the world's greatest economic power.
America's economic strength influenced its policies toward Europe during the 1920s. In fact, one of the most important issues of this period was the economic aid the United States had provided European nations during World War I. Americans lent the Allied countries $7 billion during the war. Shortly after the war, they lent another $3 billion. The Allies borrowed most of the money for military equipment and food and other needs of their people. The Allied nations suffered far greater losses of property and population than the United States during the war. And when peace came, they called on the United States to cancel the loans America had made. France, Britain, and the other Allied nations said the United States should not expect them to repay the loans.
The United States refused to cancel the debts. President Coolidge spoke for most Americans when he said simply, "They borrowed the money." He believed the European powers should pay back the war loans, even though their economies had suffered terribly during the fighting. However, the European nations had little money to pay their loans. France tried to get the money by demanding payments from Germany for having started the war. When Germany was unable to pay, France and Belgium occupied Germany's Ruhr Valley. As a result, German miners in the area reduced coal production. And France and Germany moved toward an economic crisis and possible new armed conflict.
An international group intervened and negotiated a settlement to the crisis. The group provided a system to save Germany's currency and protect international debts. American bankers agreed to lend money to Germany to pay its war debts to the Allies. And the Allies used the money to pay their debts to the United States.
Some Americans with international interests criticized President Coolidge and other conservative leaders for not reducing or canceling Europe's debts. They said the debts and the new payment plan put foolish pressure on the weak European economies. They said this made the German currency especially weak, and they warned that a weak economy would lead to serious social problems in Germany and other countries. However, most Americans did not understand the serious effect that international economic policies could have on the future of world peace. They believed that it was wrong for the Europeans, or anyone, to borrow money and then refuse to pay it back.
Many Americans of the 1920s also failed to recognize that a strong national military force would become increasingly important in the coming years. President Coolidge requested very limited military spending from the Congress. And many conservative military leaders refused to spend much money on such new kinds of equipment as submarines and airplanes. Some Americans did understand that the United States was now a world power and needed a strong and modern fighting force. One general, Billy Mitchell, publicly criticized the military leadership for not building new weapons. But most Americans were not interested. Many Americans continued to oppose arms spending until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii in 1941.
American policy toward the League of Nations did not change much in the 1920s. In 1919, the Senate denied President Wilson's plea for the United States to join the new League of Nations. The United States, however, became involved unofficially in a number of League activities, but it continued to refuse to become a full member. And in 1930, the Senate rejected a proposal for the United States to join the World Court. The United States also continued in the 1920s to refuse to recognize the communist government in Moscow. However, trade between the Soviet Union and the United States increased greatly during this period. And such large American companies as General Electric, DuPont, and RCA provided technical assistance to the new Soviet government.
The Coolidge administration was involved actively in events in Latin America. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes helped several Latin American countries to settle border disputes peacefully. In Central America, President Coolidge ordered American Marines into Nicaragua when President Adolfo Diaz faced a revolt from opposition groups. The United States gave its support to more conservative groups in Nicaragua, and it helped arrange a national election in 1928. American troops stayed in Nicaragua until 1933. However, American troops withdrew from the Dominican Republic during this period. And Secretary of State Hughes worked to give new life to the Pan-American Union.
Relations with Mexico became worse during the 1920s. In 1925, Mexican President Plutarco Elias Calles called for laws to give Mexico more control over its minerals and natural wealth. American oil companies resisted the proposed changes. They accused Calles of communism, and some American business and church leaders called for armed American intervention. However, the American Senate voted to try to settle the conflict peacefully, and American diplomat Dwight Morrow helped negotiate a successful new agreement.
These American actions in Nicaragua and Mexico showed that the United States still felt that it had special security interests south of its border. But its peaceful settlement of the Mexican crisis and support of elections in Nicaragua showed that it was willing to deal with disputes peacefully. America's policies in Latin America during the 1920s were in some ways similar to its policies elsewhere. It was a time of change, of movement, from one period to another. Many Americans were hoping to follow the traditional foreign policies of the past. They sought to remain separate from world conflict.
The United States, however, could no longer remain apart from world events. This would become clear in the coming years. Europe would face fascism and war. The Soviet Union would grow more powerful. And Latin America would become more independent. The United States was a world power, but it was still learning in the 1920s about the leadership and responsibility that is part of such power.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.